We have a relatively young team after a transition of leadership, and a lot of really brilliant people with big ideas. And I want you to talk a little bit about what's that like to be in your 20s, to have this moonshot vision, the journey of setting goals, bringing together a team, facing adversity, and ending up with basically the largest movement of its kind in the world, and mobilizing tens of billions of dollars at your age. What, one, any reflections, but also any advice to people that are currently probably sitting and saying, I have these big dreams and big ideas, but I can see all the things that are making this impossible right now. I don't have the money, I don't have the people, these people are gonna stop me, whatever the thing is.
Yeah, so I'd probably say two things. So for me, my real journey started when I was 12 years old. A lady from a charity came and spoke at our school about raising money for kids in the developing world. And when you're 12, well, I was very impressionable, and I put up my hand and I said, you know, I'd love to help raise money, right? And so I started knocking on every door I could and raised the most amount of money of any kid in Australia. And so the charity sent me to the Philippines when I was 14. And there was one night that changed my life forever, where we were taken onto a slum in the center of Manila called Smoky Mountain. It's a community built on top of a rubbish dump where the whole infrastructure revolves around scavenging. So the kids literally run after the garbage trucks every single day, and they try to get bits of scrap metal, you know, piece of food and things that they can recycle. And that night, they placed me in the care of a kid my own age. His name is Sunny Boy. We were both 14 at the time. You know, where I'd just come from middle class Melbourne, he had tattoos on his forearm because he was about to become his gang leader at the age of 14. And that was his form of initiation. And that night he took me to his house and we cooked this meal together with some food that I brought with me. But I had no idea what to expect until it came time to go to sleep. And we lay down, myself and him, the rest of his family, seven of us in this long line with this smell of rubbish all around us because we're lying on top of a garbage dump and cockroaches crawling all over us that night. And I didn't sleep a wink. I just lay awake thinking to myself, you know, it really is pure chance that I was born where I was born and he was born into extreme poverty. So my first realization and my first point today is that none of us deserve the lottery of life. We don't deserve where we're born. We don't deserve the jobs that we have. We could have all very equally have been born anywhere on the planet. And therefore, we have this inherent both opportunity and moral responsibility to have a positive impact on the lives and the lives that you can have an impact on while we're alive. Warren Buffett called it the ovarian lottery. I think it's the right way to think about it. So that's my first big piece of advice. Always be thankful, always be grateful, and always remember the context of the world that we're operating in. And I think the second piece of advice, which is hard because sometimes, particularly when you build a big organization like Global Citizen has become in 10 years, you've got more to lose than when you're the scrappy startup, you know what I mean? Like, and so sometimes the stakes are a lot higher. But I always try to keep in mind the wisdom of our first chairman of Global Citizen. He said, your goal is not to build an organization or a bureaucracy. Your goal is to build a movement. And that movement should always outlast you. So whatever you're trying to do, don't conflate the way in which structures force you to become established versus what you're actually trying to achieve. And so for us at Global Citizen, I hope we will be out of business in 15 years when extreme poverty is eradicated. I hope we'll have nothing more to do. We'll close our doors and no one will come to Central Park except for a celebration of what's happened. I don't want us to be like every other charity that becomes fat and bloated and continues to exist long after they need to. I want us to work ourselves out of business. And so my advice would be, if you're driven by your own passion to create change, don't do so out of fear and that fear of existing. Drive it to the point in which there is a world in which you no longer exist.
Yeah, and the thing I've seen you do that I think is really translatable to a lot of people in different positions, because change happens in many places and on many verticals, is the thing you do very well, and I think it came through in where you started that answer from, is there's such a crisp and deep belief in the where I'm going and why, that every time Hugh calls me and he has this big idea, and I'm like, I get exhausted just from the conversation of thinking about what it would take to get us from here to there. But because Hugh is so clear on where and why, those obstacles become very small. And he just, well, we're gonna get around it. We gotta raise the money, we gotta get to that person, we gotta get these things, but they're so small next to that clarity. And I take a lesson from that of, it feels the obstacles, the why not feels super big when the end goal and the why I'm doing it is hazy. I mean, it's really easy to throw us off track. When those are so clear, where there isn't a window, there's a door. If it's not a door, it's a chimney. If it's not a chimney, we'll break the wall. And it's a real lesson that I took away from that, and that I think a lot of us can just think about the things we're passionate about in that way.